Hello, everyone. This is Mireille Genot, and you're listening to the New Books in African Studies podcast. Joining me today is Professor Jean-Germain Gros, Professor of Political Science and Public Policy Administration at the University of Missouri, St. Louis in St. Louis, Missouri. He's the author of State Failure, Underdevelopment, and Foreign Intervention in Haiti, and the co-author of When Reality Contradicts Rhetoric, World Bank Lending Practices in Developing Countries in Historical, Theoretical, and Empirical Perspectives. Today we'll be discussing his new book, Healthcare Policy in Africa, Institutions and Politics from Colonialism to the Present, published by Roman and Littlefield. Professor Grohl, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be with you today.
Great. I wonder if you would begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, I am as you mentioned, a professor of political science and public policy administration at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, USA. I started as an assistant professor and became a full professor in 2013. I did my graduate work at the University of California at Berkeley, political science. My areas of specialty were African politics, comparative politics, and public administration. I received the master's degree from the State University of New York at Binghamton, an MPA, Master's in Public Administration, and before that, a bachelor's degree also from the State University of New York at Binghamton in economics and sociology. I have visited and worked in about 15 African countries. I was born in the Caribbean, specifically in Haiti. So my work basically spans the African world, both diaspora and continental.
I really enjoyed reading this book, and I really enjoyed the fact, just the fact of this book, because I think it it certainly contributes a significant amount to the scholarship regarding healthcare in Africa. So I'm really looking forward to hearing you talk more about it. I wonder if we'd begin with your introduction, where you go through a review of the dominant schools of thought in policy studies, and you explicate some key terms that recur throughout the book, among those healthcare policy and public policy. And I wonder if you could give us a working definition of healthcare policy.
Well, as you mentioned, basically in the book, I start by examining the state of African studies in the last 30 years. And what I notice is that policy in Africa has tended to be neglected. In the 1980s, the emphasis in African studies was on structural adjustment, economic reform, which was understandable because the 1980s are known in African studies as Africa's lost decade. And then at the beginning of the 1990s, you had a transition from a focus on economic reform to a focus on democratic reform, democratic transition. And then towards the end of the 1990s and early 2000, the focus again shifted to conflicts, state failure, particularly ethnic conflicts in the Great Lakes. So what I try to do in this chapter and in this book is to fill in the gap in African studies by focusing on policy, specifically healthcare policy. What do I mean by healthcare policy? Well, healthcare policy refers to the actions or decisions undertaken by the authorities of a community, such as a country, regarding the health of its citizens. These decisions can either be active or passive, that is to say, non-decisions. However, I hasten to point out that even though government tends to underwrite healthcare policy, government actors are not the only actors in the making of healthcare policy. In developing countries in particular, numerous non-governmental organizations and private actors are also involved in the process, sometimes even supplanting or surpassing government. And so to take an example, in Rwanda, cancer care, the largest provider of cancer care is basically Partners in Health, which is located in a town called Butaro. In addition, Partners in Health trains Rwandan cancer specialists. Before that, before Partners in Health, there were very few cancer specialists in Rwanda. Now, this one organization, working closely with the government of Rwanda, is training doctors in cancer treatment. So even though government tends to play an important role in healthcare policy, it is not the only actor. In developing countries, non-governmental organizations and private actors also play a key role in the making as well as the implementation of healthcare policy.
Right, and that's essentially the central thesis of the book, which is that African healthcare policy does not take place in a vacuum, and many factors, including globalization and brain drain, affect policy.
Yes, you're quite correct. And so I focus in chapter one on both the theories that informed, you know, public policy, as well as the factors more or less unique to Africa, unique between quotation marks, that influence healthcare policy for good and bad. And one of these factors is, globalization. That is to say, what I call the spread of information, communication, and transportation technology, and the brain drain that it is facilitating in Africa, which has negative consequences for how healthcare policy is implemented throughout the continent.
Yeah, and I would encourage listeners to pay particular attention in that first chapter to an interesting challenge you make to the sort of current definitions of globalization, and you choose instead to define globalization as technological innovation that makes possible the flow of capital, rather than globalization as the spread of capitalism. I thought that was particularly interesting point and framing this early chapter.
Right. No, the key point here is that if you focus on globalization as the rapid spread of information, communication, and transportation technology, then you can see that it facilitates the spread of other things, including, you know, ideas regarding how you structure an economy, in other words, capitalism or democracy. So the substance of globalization is not the result, but rather the phenomenon itself. That is to say, the spread of various kinds of technologies which facilitate the transcendence of other things such as the economy, the democracy, and so on. And so globalization, for example, is playing an important role in African healthcare, to the extent that in some African hospitals, such as, again, Partners in Health's hospital in Butawa, Rwanda, surgeries being performed in Rwanda can now be observed by doctors at Massachusetts General Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so surgery, which we used to think of as a very intimate medical intervention, now has jumped borders because of globalization. That is to say, because of communication and technology. And we have a number of instances and a number of other examples like this, where, again, technology is driving how we think about healthcare, how we frame healthcare issues. So things such as total quality management, managed care. In other words, the very language, the very idioms that African healthcare policymakers use now to talk about healthcare in Africa essentially are driven by technology. And so in Ghana, there is an emphasis on having, electronic medical files, okay, as a way of reducing costs and managing the Ghanaian healthcare system back better. You see, there is also an emphasis on providing information about different kinds of providers so that Ghanaian patients can make informed decisions. Again, this is being driven by information technology.
Interesting. Well, and I'll definitely ask you to come back to the Ghanaian example later on in our discussion, because it's a very rich example and provides insight into a lot of the things taken up in the book. So, I wonder though if we moved on to your second chapter, which discusses healthcare policy in colonial Africa, specifically from 1870 to 1960, and one of the things that I thought was interesting about this part of the book is that you make a point to suggest that the historiography of healthcare policy in Africa should begin not with the late 19th century Berlin Conference, but rather with the exploration period that immediately precedes it. So I wonder if you would say why you think that's so, this accounting for healthcare policy should begin then, and also what you mean by healthcare policy in this period being, quote, limited in scope and coverage.
Okay. Well, good question. I would even like to preface, before I answer your question, my comment by observing that even before the exploration period, in the 1870s, Africa had healthcare policy. This is very important. I don't mean to suggest that before, presence of Europeans in Africa, there was no healthcare system and there were no healthcare policies. And again, if I may use the case that I know more about, Ghana and colonial Ghana and Ashanti land, the Asantehene, the king, essentially mandated that people use boiled water to clean their latrine. This is evidence that even in colonial Africa, people understood the connection between public health and good health. If you go back even further to so-called medieval Africa, in Timbuktu, the archive of Timbuktu contain extensive documents regarding medical practices in medieval Africa, practices which were in some ways more advanced than medical practices in Europe, where until the 19th century, it was common for people to be bled to death, because people thought that what caused disease was bad blood. And so therefore they would drain your plasma and people would die that way. As far as we know, that practice was not, widely adopted in Africa. So coming back now to your question, yes, I talk about 1870 or the 1870s rather than 1885 as the beginning of sort of more systematized healthcare system in colonial Africa, because it was really with the exploration efforts that a European presence deep into the interior of Africa was contemplated. And so during this period, before this period, the European presence in Africa, in West Africa particularly, was limited to the coast and it was limited to trade. But with the exploration period, that set the stage for a more sustained presence, that is to say, for colonialism. So during this period, men like David Livingstone, Emin Pasha, Savognin di Braza, John Rawlins, who was also known as Henry Morton Stanley, you know, went into a deeper effort to understand Africa and to set the geography and the topography of Africa and to set the stage for colonialism. So as they went into these explorations, they encountered diseases which they had to cure for themselves. So they fell sick, and so they had to treat themselves. In addition, in these explorations, medical specialists were often part of the equipage, because even in this period, what you find is that medical specialists were used in order to develop amity with local Africans. So these explorations would treat not only the explorers, but the Africans that the explorers met along the way. Now, I should also mention that relationships between local Africans and explorers were not always cordial. So sometimes there were fights between them. And that, of course, whenever people fight, there are injuries which need to be treated. And so these explorations also had a medical component stemming from conflicts, in addition to epidemiological problems. Mm-hmm. And of course, some of these explorers were missionaries as well. And later, during colonialism proper, missionaries came to play a very important role in colonial medicine. In some ways, in fact, missionary medicine was much more important, much more extensive than colonial state-provided medicine. In other words, the medical missionaries were the real pioneer and the advent of systematic so-called modern, healthcare systems in Africa.
Well, and along with that, one of the things you talk about in this chapter, with the example of the British Medical Act, right, is that that at a certain point in the colonial period, Western-trained African doctors were denied the right to practice medicine in their own countries. So I would think that would also sort of consolidate that hold that the missionary medicine or medical missionaries sort of had on treatment and policy.
Right. One of the things that happened in the 1920s is that you begin to have a core of medical providers who were African. In countries like Liberia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, you had at first so-called African, bush doctors. They were not fully, medical doctors in the Western sense, but they did have medical knowledge. And of course, in the 1930s and 1940s, you did have people who did become full medical doctors, such as Kamuzu Banda in Malawi, and even Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who was not fully a medical doctor, who had advanced medical training. Generally speaking, these providers were excluded from practicing medicine, or there were severe constraints placed upon them, because among other things, colonial officials did not want for African medical providers to treat European women, for example. Also, by limiting competition from African medical providers, European medical providers in Africa could keep their status and their wages or salaries.
Right.
So there were various reasons, some economic, some social, and some quite frankly racist, that limited the... Also, the colonial state, quite frankly, did not make it a priority to train African doctors and other medical providers. For a variety of reasons, the supply of medical providers during colonialism was limited. But yes, after a decade or so of colonialism on the continent, you did begin to have, trained African medical providers, some doctors, some nurses, some what we may now call nurse practitioners, developing in the 1920s. And certainly by the end of colonialism, there was, in some countries, a fairly decent supply of medical providers, such as in Senegal, for example. Mm-hmm.
Well, so the one of the things that this chapter introduces that continues throughout the book is this, I don't know what the best term, whether it's a clash or a confrontation between a sort of Western approach to medicine, to illness, which is a biomedical approach, that in opposition to an indigenous African approach. And I wonder if you would explain for us what this biomedical approach sort of consists of.
Okay. Good question once again. During colonialism, there was a clash among many clashes between Africans and Europeans in terms of how you view disease and how you treat disease. The African medical epistemology and worldview, disease was a combination of physical ailments and spiritual ailments. In other words, it was a combination of physics and metaphysics. Thus, the treatment of disease required not only intervention on the body, but also intervention on the spirit. So African medical intervention, but in the lower Congo, for example, included drumming, singing, praying, in addition to using, herbal medicine. This was in contrast with the Western view of medicine and the Western view of disease, which basically saw disease as stemming from biological breakdown of the body, which could be repaired by chemicals. Okay. And so in Western medical epistemology, if someone is sick, you do one of two things, both of which have to do with intervening on the body. So we can talk, and I talk in the chapter of biopower, mm-hmm. biomedical power. And in Western medical practice, if somebody is sick, you give them medicine, you give them drugs, so that you can reestablish the equilibrium in the body through chemistry. The second thing that you do is you provide surgery. Okay? In other words, you repair the body part. So this is the view of the body as machine and of the medical provider as a mechanic. In Africa, the medical provider was both a mechanic and a priest. However, African missionaries looked down on spiritual, since European missionaries, looked down on spiritual, on African spirituality, they tended to view the more metaphysical part of African medicine as superstition, and therefore as something that they should crack down on. Ironically, we are now seeing that the African view of disease was the correct one. That increasingly in Western medicine, we recognize that you not only intervene on the body, but also the predisposition of the mind has an important bearing on how well the body is repaired. So Africans had the correct view all along, that is to say, a holistic approach to curing disease involving, you know, physical intervention and spiritual intervention. So I thought that that was a very interesting. So sometimes the oppressor can learn from the oppressed.
Absolutely. Well, so continuing in that vein, right? If we could discuss the third and fourth chapters of the book, they are both titled "Healthcare Policy in Postcolonial Africa." Chapter three is subtitled "The Influence of External Institutions." I wonder if we hear you discuss the internationalization of healthcare policy and presumably some of what you've just discussed, which is this turn in Western medicine to recognize the not just the value, but the necessity of a holistic approach to illness and medicine. You cite a number of examples in the chapter of this internationalization of healthcare policy. In particular, you privilege the example of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, the MCC. And I wonder if you would tell us what makes the MCC especially worthy of critical analysis.
Okay. So chapter two argues that African healthcare policy was internationalized during the colonial period, and that set the stage for the further internationalization of healthcare policy in Africa in the post-colonial period, so that you cannot understand healthcare policy in post-colonial Africa without understanding the colonial period. The internationalization of healthcare policy in post-colonial Africa is due to a variety of factors, not just colonialism, but the fact that African countries continue to be highly dependent on international institutions, particularly aid institutions, foreign aid institutions. So one of these institutions, in fact, the latest, is the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which was previously called the Millennium Challenge Account. It was first announced by former President George W. Bush in 2002. And it represents, as I say in the book, the latest example of the internationalization of healthcare policy in post-colonial Africa. So what is the Millennium Challenge Corporation? Basically, it was an organization created to provide grants, not loans, to countries in exchange for these countries undertaking economic, political, and social policy reforms in order to accelerate economic growth and reduce poverty. In other words, the MCC was and is a continuation of the policy-based lending of the 1980s, except that the MCC is a creation of the U.S. government, whereas the policy-based lending of the 1980s, which was embedded in structural adjustment, were pushed generally by the World Bank and the IMF. So under MCC rule, countries apply for grants to the MCC, and the MCC developed a number of NDCs or matrices and decide whether countries, the project proposed by these countries meet the criteria, the performance criteria, as spelled out by the MCC. So performance indicators include economic freedom, ruling justly, and investing in people. So you can imagine if a country wants, help in healthcare, it puts together a grant proposal that demonstrates that it is going to invest and improve health conditions of its citizens. And so that would fall under investing in people. And technically, that would qualify such countries for MCCA. The problem with the MCC is that these performance indicators, are generally decided by MCC. So they are kind of a report card that are given to countries, and they are also grades that are given to countries. So both the report cards and the grades are provided by the MCC, as well as the performance indicators. So the MCC is both, judge and executioner, so to speak, both player and referee. And so African countries pretend to be partners, or should I say recipient countries, pretend to be partners with the MCC, when in fact they are at best junior partners. Mm-hmm. It is the MCC that decides, that makes the key decision. So to give you an example outside of Africa, there is probably no country in the developing world that has invested more in human development than Cuba, particularly where health is concerned. You know, Cuba has more, doctors per capita than any country in the world, including the United States. But it is a safe bet that Cuba, at least for the foreseeable future, is not likely to be qualified for MCC grants under investing in people. So for other reasons. And so the MCC, while it is theoretically an innovation and aid policy to the extent that it stresses accountability, but it also further perpetuates dependence, the dependence of recipient countries on U.S. aid, and it also demonstrates that, or at least it has the potential of underscoring the fact that priorities that are not regarded as priorities of the MCC will not be funded, thus driving home the point that the MCC is a way of, or maybe a way of remaking recipient countries in the image of the U.S. government rather than their own image.
Well, and that's...
And so if I may continue, so the key point here is that American aid is given to countries, or the willingness of American aid to be given to countries hinges on these countries pursuing market-friendly economic policies and democracy and other social policies that meet with American approval, rather than the approval of the citizens of those countries themselves.
Yeah, and that's a great opportunity for us to talk again about the fourth chapter, which talks is subtitled "Measuring the Impact of Local Institutions," because I think one of the persistent perceptions and narratives is of this imbalance in terms of what African countries or states are willing or able to do in terms of setting policy for their citizens, and as you discussed just now, establishing policies that are reflective of the will of the citizens of the countries rather than of external agents, whether donors or other actors. So I think in this chapter, just again for the benefit of our listeners, you take up this idea of how local institutions, not of external origin in this case, of a macrosocial character, empirically influence healthcare policy. And I wonder if you could talk about that. I was particularly interested in this chapter, your discussion of spending, right, of government spending on healthcare. And I would love it if you would share some more about that.
Yes, this is the empirical part of the study, in that it is in this chapter in which I try to measure, health policy outcomes and try to account for, and try to provide an explanation of healthcare policy outcomes. This is a very standard approach in healthcare policy studies. It was pioneered essentially by Joseph Newhouse of the RAND Corporation in the early 1970s, who asked a very basic question. And that is, what is the connection between national health and healthcare spending on the one hand, and what is the connection between healthcare spending and healthcare outcomes? Joseph Newhouse asked these questions for developed countries in the early 1970s. What I try to do is to ask these same questions as they apply to African countries. Because again, we know a lot more about healthcare in developed countries than we do in developing countries. Mm-hmm. Certainly than we do about, regarding African countries. So in this chapter, one of the questions that I ask is, what is the connection between national health and healthcare spending in Africa? This is not just an academic question. In 2001, African countries met in Abuja, Nigeria, and pledged to devote at least 15% of their annual budget on their healthcare systems. 15%. So the question that I try to answer in this chapter is, did African countries meet that objective by 2013 when I was writing the book? And that question, dovetails nicely with the bigger question regarding the connection between wealth and healthcare spending and healthcare outcomes. And so what I found, among other things in this chapter, so I have data for 46 African countries. Let me make that very clear. So the great majority of African countries is included in this study. That is to say 84% of Africa's states are part of this study. Did African countries meet the goal of the Abuja Declaration, which was to devote 15% of their annual budget on their healthcare sector? What I found was that generally speaking, African countries, between 2001, when the policy was enunciated, and 2012 and 2013, so that's like a 10 to 11 year period, a 12 year period, African countries did not meet the goal of the Abuja Declaration, which was to devote 15% of their budget to health. However, what I found, which was very interesting, was that to the extent that African countries were approaching meeting the Abuja Declaration, or even meeting it, it was not the richer countries, it was the poor countries. So that's sort of counterintuitive. You would have expected, you know, the Nigerias, the South Africans, you know, the wealthier African countries to have easily met the goal of the Abuja Declaration, which was once again to devote 15% of their budget, of their annual budget to healthcare. And instead, what I found were countries like, you know, Rwanda, somewhat surprisingly, Liberia. I said somewhat surprisingly because Liberia, you know, went through a very brutal civil war in the 1990s. Okay, so so what I found was that it was rather the poorest African countries that tended to devote a greater share of their annual budget to health care. And so that calls for an explanation. And the most plausible one for me, given the data, was that the poorest African countries had qualified for debt relief during this period, provided that they use the foregone interest payments to devote to their healthcare system. And I think that that is the main reason for the improvement of the poorest African countries, and spending a greater share of their budget on healthcare. So this demonstrates that debt relief can make a difference. It demonstrates that, it is possible to, for countries to increase their commitment to healthcare spending with some help from the international community. And some of these poorest countries, you also have a commitment, a greater commitment by government. So Rwanda, for example, explicitly devote almost like 20 to 25% of its budget on healthcare. So in addition to international institution, national government commitment also matters. In other words, local institutions also matter. And then the second part of the question you may recall is, what is the impact of healthcare spending on healthcare outcomes? And so what I did here was I took some of the healthcare-related Millennium Development Goals, specifically MDG 4, MDG 5, and MDG 6. So these were goals that were established by the United Nations in 2000. And so I asked which African countries were more likely or more unlikely to come closest to meeting these MDGs or to not meeting them. Okay. And again, what I've found was that there is not necessarily a correlation in Africa between national wealth and healthcare outcomes. But there is a connection between healthcare spending and healthcare outcomes. In other words, the countries that tend to spend more on healthcare spending, meaning the poorest African countries, experience drastic improvement in the MDG 4, 5, and 6. In fact, what I found in some instances is that the richer African countries, such as South Africa, did not make substantial improvement in MDG 6, for example, such as reducing HIV/AIDS. Okay. And so there is a connection between healthcare spending and healthcare outcome. Thus, spending does matter, poor countries that commit to healthcare spending can experience fairly significant positive healthcare outcomes. And so it does matter what countries spend on their healthcare system. So that's the main idea in this chapter, is to empirically examine the impact of institutions, local institutions, on policy and on policy and on outcomes. Now, some of these institutions that I call local are somewhat arbitrary. Thus, one of the institutions that I look at is ICT, information and communication technology. Of course, you know, the internet, for example, was not invented in Africa. But it is local in the sense that, you know, Africans use the internet and other forms of communication technology in their social and economic relations. So we examine ICT, we examine government, we examine economies, and we examine regime types, meaning democracy. Another interesting variable, independent variable that we look to examine healthcare policy and healthcare outcome is what I call stateness. In other words, the degree to which countries have a working state, I initially hypothesized would have some bearing on their healthcare policy and healthcare policy outcomes. And I didn't find that to be the case, by the way, which was kind of disappointing, but it is what it is. Because I had expected for so-called failed states to for state failure to have an impact. I explained that in the chapter, why I think that is not the case, but that was one of the intriguing results that we had to deal with.
Well, and in the same way that you use stateness in that chapter, in the following chapter, which deals with healthcare policy in Africa and humanitarianism, you actually use the embeddedness of humanitarian organizations as a means of classification, right? An organizing principle to determine what humanitarian organizations are and what sorts of impacts they have on policy. So I wonder if we could turn to that, because I think, again, there's so many interesting connections in the last chapter you were discussing. Debt relief, say, is one form of help from the international community, and humanitarianism, right, is another really obvious form of help. So if you could discuss that would be great.
Yes. Well, actually, this is a very nice segue into a very important topic. I didn't do this in the book, but I wish that I had now that I'm speaking to you. And that is, it may very well be that the reason why stateness does not have much of an impact on health policy outcome, that may well be due to the presence of humanitarian organizations. But I didn't examine that in the book. Nevertheless, humanitarian organizations, you know, play a very important role in African healthcare systems. I call them humanitarian organizations or institutions. Other people refer to them as NGOs. Non-governmental organizations. So what I try to do, so Africa probably has more of these organizations than any other continent, right? And so in Tanzania, for example, in the early 2000s, the number of NGOs was estimated at 10,000, right? So humanitarian organizations, they play an important role in social policy making in Africa, perhaps more so in healthcare than any other area. In 2007, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation allocated 61% of its grants, which was the equivalent of $1.2 billion to global health programs, many of which were in Africa. However, there are humanitarian organizations and there are humanitarian organizations. In other words, not all humanitarian organizations work the same way or are the same or are of the same size. So one important thing that I try to do in this chapter is to construct a typology or a taxonomy of humanitarian organizations. And basically, I construct this typology based on what I call the degree of embeddedness of various humanitarian organizations with the local institutions in Africa, particularly the state. So there are certain humanitarian organizations that maintain very deep ties to the state. So I call them the deeply embedded humanitarian organization. So these organizations, in fact, can be seen as the implementing agents of the state. So state officials, they make policy and then they more or less rely on these humanitarian organizations to implement policy. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's the deeply embedded humanitarian organization. So it's part of it's part of the system of governance, mm-hmm. in other words. And then you have other types of humanitarian organizations that are less embedded with the state and other local institutions. So one example of a deeply embedded humanitarian organization would be Paul Farmer's Partners in Health, which I talked about earlier in Rwanda. But Partners in Health also operate, you know, clinics in Lesotho and in Swaziland and outside of Africa in Haiti. In all of these countries, basically, Partners in Health, if I may be redundant, partners with local governments, national governments, and become essentially part of the state-provided or state-supported healthcare system. But this is not the way all humanitarian organizations necessarily operate. There are some humanitarian organizations that make it a policy to keep their distance vis-a-vis local institutions, particularly the state. So I call them conditionally embedded humanitarian organization. Conditionally embedded humanitarian organization. They try to maintain a certain distance from the state so that they can operate with independence. There is some advantage to doing that, in that if you become too closely affiliated with a government, particularly with a non-democratic government, should that government lose power, as a humanitarian organization, you may find yourself, you know, being thrown out of the country. Okay, but at the same time, by partnering with a with an existing government, you may have access to resources and you may have freedom of mobility that you may not otherwise have had if you had maintained your distance. So how much humanitarian organizations are embedded or not embedded in the societies in which they operate offer advantages and disadvantages. And so as a humanitarian organization, you have to decide, you know, which strategy is best for you. In the book, I talk about a very interesting type of humanitarian organization. That is what I call the globally embedded, and multifaceted humanitarian organization, GEMO. An example of that would be the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Carter Center would be an example, would be another example of a globally embedded and multifaceted humanitarian organization. So these are what I call them the humanitarian equivalent of multinational corporations. In fact, as you well know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was founded by the former head of one of the largest multinational corporations, right, Microsoft. Okay. So this is something that has happened in the late 20th century and early 21st century, where multimillionaires and billionaires are establishing foundations that are transnational in scope and that are also multifaceted. So if you look at the early humanitarian organizations in the West, such as, you know, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, they did do some work overseas, but generally speaking, they were national in scope and interest. Now what you have is, again, the internationalization of humanitarian humanitarian work, and so the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation dwarfs not only the budget of healthcare ministries in Africa, but the budget even of the World Health Organization. So in this sense, humanitarianism is getting even bigger than states and multilateral agencies, right? But another thing that's occurring in healthcare in Africa is that you are beginning to have, as more and more Africans become billionaires, you are also beginning to have Africa-centered and Africa-born humanitarian organizations that are also transnational.
Like the Dangote Foundation.
So you have the Dangote Foundation in Nigeria. It's based in Nigeria, but it played an important role, for example, during the Ebola crisis in Liberia. You have the Shandaria Foundation in Kenya, which is led by the Shandaria, you know, conglomerate. This is a very interesting development in that historically in Africa, you know, Africans, wealthier Africans, were engaged in humanitarian work, but they tended to be informal. Okay? It is, as I mentioned in the chapter, it is a rare African of some means that do not take care of at least the extended family, if not, you know, the village. So there has always been humanitarian work in Africa by the well-to-do, but now it's becoming more systematized and more organized. But I hesitate to say more Western.
Right.
But you get my point. And furthermore, these humanitarian organizations, like the Dangote Foundation, they are not only operating outside of the African country of origin, they are even operating outside of the continent. So during the earthquake in Pakistan, for example, in the first decade of the 2000, the Dangote Foundation donated money to Pakistan. Okay, that's an important development, at least for me, in that, Africa and the popular imagination is always thought of as a sort of as a recipient place, and Africans as taking. Well, Africans are also giving, in the humanitarian field, and that's an interesting. It's an interesting development. So, as more and more Africans succeed economically, we can expect the humanitarian sector in Africa to become more Africa-centered, and that may have consequences for the type of projects, health projects that they pursue, that they may pursue projects that are more sensitive to African needs rather than sensitive to what the West thinks Africa needs.
Yeah, and again, that sort of autonomy and freedom to determine their own course is something interesting that came up as well in this chapter, which is the cultural differences with regard to charity, and this again we don't need to go into it, but these cultural differences in terms of how Africans view charity and humanitarianism again are present something of a divergence along the same lines as you discussed in earlier chapters, you know, different approaches to illness and healing and medicine. So, I really did at the risk of betraying a favorite chapter. The chapter on humanitarianism might well have been one I enjoyed most. So, but that's not to slight any of the other chapters, including the sixth chapter, where you look in particular at healthcare policy in Botswana, Ghana, and Rwanda. The chapter subtitle is Agency and Institutions. And in, you conclude in this chapter that agency and institutions determine healthcare policy in these three countries where one might expect agency, which you define, I should say, much earlier in the book, to be the sole determinant of policy. And so I wonder, starting from this conclusion, if you tell us why, so what's the basis there, right? Why we might expect agency to be the sole determinant of policy? Maybe what you mean by agency, elite agency specifically. That'd be great.
Okay. Well, first of all, why Botswana, Ghana, and Rwanda out of 55 African countries?
Right.
I chose these three countries because I thought that they represent, in spite of the smallness, if I may use this term, of the sample size, I thought that these three countries represent sort of the gamut of African countries. Botswana is a middle-income African country, so it could be seen to represent other middle-income African countries, of which there are admittedly few, I think about 14. Ghana is a low-middle-income country, so it could be seen to represent low-middle-income African countries, and Rwanda is a low-income African countries, so it could be seen to represent African countries in that category. So that's the reason for choosing these three countries. Furthermore, all three countries have made universal access a centerpiece of their healthcare policy. In other words, they have a policy in common whose results I thought could be measured and compared. So we can say that the choice of these three countries was a kind of stratified sampling, if I may be somewhat technical. Also, collectively, Botswana, Ghana, and Rwanda are representative of the political regimes of contemporary Africa. Botswana is a democratic country. Ghana is well on its way to being democratic, and Rwanda is somewhat more problematic, but nevertheless I thought that it represented a good number of the political regimes that exist in Africa. So there are good reasons for focusing on these two countries, on these three countries, rather. And so what I do in the chapter is to look at their history, look at the type of government that they have, the type of economy, the type of healthcare policy that they've pursued. So if you consider healthcare policy as the sort of dependent variable in these countries, the question is what has driven that policy? And so the approach here is that of historical policy analysis. I look at basically the post-colonial history of each of these countries and then ask, in that history, what factors appear to be most crucial in determining healthcare policy? And what became recurring in all three cases is agency. And by agency, I mean elite commitment to healthcare. Okay. Botswana at independence was extremely poor. It had a per capita GDP of $65 per year. And of course, Botswana became a major, in fact, the biggest producer of cut diamonds in the world. Okay. But other African countries also have diamonds. But have not done as well as Botswana. So what that suggests is that, natural resource endowment per se, does not guarantee success. It is the use to which such endowment is put that makes a difference. And here we're talking about elite. We're talking about management of resources. Same thing in Ghana. At independence, the Nkrumah government was very much committed to an inclusive healthcare system. But Ghana went through a very tough time in the 1970s, and especially in 1980s, if you recall, in 1984-85, when thousands of Ghanaians were thrown out of Nigeria. So Ghana became a kind of poster child in the 1980s for African stagnation. In the 1990s, under the former PNDC, now NDC government led by Jerry Rawlings, the economy started to pick up again. And then by 2000 or the early part of the 21st century, the economic growth in Ghana became more more sustainable, never really of Chinese-like scope, like 10 to 12% growth per annum, but decent, 4 to 5%. So as the economy of Ghana has picked up, Ghana has sort of returned to its earlier commitment to healthcare. Again, underscoring the importance of agency. So it seems that the idea of, and I criticize this term in the book, but we can use it here in a limited way. There is the notion in policy studies of a policy window in which sometimes a policy is not necessarily abandoned, but is put aside because of adverse circumstances. And then when those circumstances change, then the policy is revived. But that cannot happen unless you have elites. who, or unless you have elite agencies who can revive such policies. Okay, so agency matters, but of course it's not just agency, it's also institution.
Sure.
Okay, no matter how much, for example, the Ghanaian elite wanted to revive healthcare a la Kwame Nkrumah, if the economy was not in demand, they would not have been able to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have to look at agency and institutions jointly, but I tilt toward agency a little bit more because I believe that, you know, human action matters. Okay, but perhaps nowhere is agency, is the importance of agency underscored than in Rwanda. I mean, Rwanda, this is a country that experienced genocide. You know, in 1994, it lost anywhere between 800,000 and 1 million people in the span of 3 years. And I remember writing an article, my very first article as a young faculty member was on failed states. And at that time, I classified Rwanda as a failed state. That was back in 1995. Well, I can tell you that Rwanda is not in that category, at least for the past 10 years. and it is one of the biggest spenders on healthcare in Africa. Why? Because of the commitment of the RPF, led by Paul Kagame, to improving healthcare and other social conditions, which the Rwandese regime see as a way of legitimizing itself. Mm-hmm. Okay. The regime does not necessarily use democratic or political legitimacy. It uses social legitimacy. So it sees healthcare spending, healthcare education, housing, and other things as the basis for its legitimacy. Thus, it spends, again, anywhere between a quarter to a fifth, anywhere between a fifth and a quarter of its annual budget on health. That's pretty impressive, and that would not have happened by itself. The elite made the calculation that improving the standards of living of people mattered for our right to govern. Okay, but again, that commitment would not have been honored if the Rwandese government, or as they say, the Rwandan government, did not perform better economically. So again, it's not agency versus institution, it's agency and institution with a kind of tilt toward agency. Mm-hmm. But other social scientists may disagree. They may give more weight to institution, but in the final analysis, I tilt more toward agency because I believe that development and underdevelopment is ultimately caused by people.
Right.
Economies do not just happen. Economies essentially are systems in which real people participate. And so therefore it matters what kind of agent that you have that participate in an economy and what kind of state that you have that sets up the rule of the economic game. So again, agency matters.
Well, and that's a perfect segue into the final chapter of the book, which is healthcare policy in Africa in the 21st century, challenges and opportunities. Right? So the challenge is represented by the Ebola pandemic of 2014, and the opportunities are represented by the very long history of Cuban involvement in the healthcare of Africa. But picking up where you just left off, right, this idea of the role of political will, right, or agency by African leaders, so on, is a question that you sort of pose rhetorically in this final chapter, right? in comparison to Cuba, right, which has been so generous with its healthcare, human power, and the question that's posed is why not the same thing with West African countries?
Right. Yes. Cuba is a fascinating example of what is possible even in poor countries when you have the right leadership. In many ways, in 1959, at the beginning of the Cuban Revolution, Cuba was where many African countries are now and have been in the post-colonial period. In fact, in 1963, Cuba lost half of its medical doctors when they defected to the West. Imagine losing half, 50% of your medical doctors when you are under an embargo or when you are about to be put under an embargo. But today, some, 51 years later, Cuba has more per capita doctor, put more doctor per capita than any other country in the world, including the United States. So how did Cuba do it? Well, in this chapter, I show that Cuba, I should also mention, partly as a result of Cuba having more medical doctors per capita than any other country in the world, Cuban health indices, infant mortality, adult life expectancy, and you name it, Cuban health indices compare more than favorably with health indices in developed countries. Okay. So what Cuba shows is that it matters that poor countries can invest in their medical personnel and in their medical healthcare system in general. And when they do that, they can get quite positive healthcare outcomes. So in other words, you don't have to be rich to have a decent healthcare system, and you don't have to be rich to have people have healthy lives. So those are, in my view, some of the most important lessons that Africa has, that Cuba offers to Africa and to the rest of the world. So how has Cuba done it? In this chapter, I demonstrate that Cuba has planned its medical success. In other words, success does not just happen. You have to plan it and go about implementing the plan. Cuban success in healthcare can be attributed to efficient allocation of scarce resources to areas that offer the highest return on investment. And that would be public health and all of its components. And here I'm quoting Fidel Castro here. And I quote, "In the field of public health, we have been guided from the outset by a number of basic criteria. The first is to prioritize public health as one of the vital services for human society. Moreover, it is what the people value more than anything. I cannot understand how politicians do not understand that." End of quote. So I was not speaking. This was Fidel. Okay, that you have to prioritize public health as one of the vital services for human society. So Cuba did not immediately embrace biomedicine, in other words, Western medicine, after the revolution. It invested in public health first, and then it shifted to biomedicine in the mid-1970s without sacrificing public health. Mm-hmm. Okay. In fact, the two go together. A good public health system makes biomedical intervention more effective. Right. So, for example, a public health system means you have you vaccinate everybody. Right. So it means having a population that is immunized. Well, you know that immunization does not necessarily prevent that you won't get sick 100%. But if you are immunized and you should get sick, you are an easier patient to treat than if you are not immunized. Right? So biomedical intervention and public health are complementary. But there is a kind of sequencing to that. You have to invest in public health first, which is also cheaper, so you can get more bang for the buck. Once you get people healthy, you get them vaccinated, you get them to drink clean drinking water, and so on, then you can shift to treating the more, chronic diseases such as, heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, etc. Okay. And so that's what Cuba did. Cuba invested in public health before it could invest in biomedicine. The problem in Africa is this, that because in part of the legacy of the colonial period, African governments have tended to prioritize biomedicine over public health. Furthermore, the institutions of biomedicine have tended to have an urban bias. So virtually all of the largest hospitals in Africa tend to be located in cities, for example. Okay. And so to get care, so-called advanced care, people have to come to the city. Okay. But if you have a good public health system that relies on an extensive network of dispensaries and primary healthcare clinics, you don't need to build large hospitals in cities. Okay? Because hospitals are the most costly item in any country's healthcare budget. Okay? So you get more bang for the buck, once again, by investing in public health. So that's the lesson of Cuba, the first lesson of Cuba for Africa, that Africans need to rediscover, investing in public health, because a good public health system which emphasizes prevention then can set the stage for and facilitate, biomedicine. Cuba, as I suggested also, has invested in healthcare personnel very heavily, such as doctors and nurses, rather than high-tech medicine, such as machines. Okay, as I mentioned before, in 1959, the year of the revolution, Cuba had an estimated 6,000 doctors, many of whom were practicing in the greater Havana area. By 1963, Cuba had lost half that number. Okay. But by 1985, Cuba had trained Cuba had trained 70,594 doctors, 159,000 nurses, and 6,640 dentists. This is on pages 256 and 257 of my book. So Cuba does not waste time training doctors. In the West, it can take as many as 10 years to train one doctor who is then deeply in debt. Because as you know, medical school in this country, is basically supported by medical students. In Cuba, medical school is free. And by that, I mean medical school is financed entirely by the state. Furthermore, the medical school curriculum is designed by a panel of experts who determine the health problems faced by humanity in general and the Cuban population in particular. And then that same panel identifies the specific skills that doctors will need to handle these problems, as well as the basic theoretical knowledge undergirding these skills. One of the problems in the U.S., as you may know, is that people are trained not in the areas that are where there is the most need, but often in the areas that command the biggest salary because of the debt incurred by medical students. So the U.S. healthcare system and Western healthcare systems in general emphasize specialization over general practice. But to have a healthy population, what you need is general practitioners. Okay, that's the lesson provided by Cuba, training general practitioners who are also trained in public health. And so when you go to Africa, you find that in many countries, the people providing general practitioners, who are general practitioners and who are providing public health, particularly in the rural areas, tend to be Cuban volunteers. Okay. So I advocate in Chapter 7 an arrangement whereby Cuba does with African countries what it already does in Venezuela, for example, where in exchange for oil, say in Nigeria, Cuban doctors would be sent to augment the number of Nigerian doctors and nurses. You might do the same also in Angola and countries that do not have oil but that have some other minerals. It's possible, in other words, for Cuba and African countries to engage in ways that are mutually beneficial, because Cuba is also a poor country, but it has done tremendously well in the medical sphere, in the medical field. In fact, Cuba's number one export is, medical skills. So there is no reason why it cannot sell such skills and share such skills. Well, it already shares them, but shares even more with African countries. But even if that were to be the case, you would still be left with the problem of brain drain, right? So even if you increase the supply of doctors, the supply of nurses, dentists in Africa, how do you prevent these people from leaving? So you have to look at the environment in which healthcare is provided in Africa and see what help can be done to encourage people to stay. So people who work for the government in the medical field may be given a bonus, for instance, to practice in the rural areas. There is a tremendous gap in the doctor-patient ratio in Africa. African doctors tend to be concentrated in cities, leaving the countryside without medical providers. So giving people bonuses, offering them subsidies for their houses and petrol for their cars, you have to figure out a way of keeping people in, okay, without using force. Africa also has to develop capacity in its healthcare systems by cooperating across borders. Do you realize that in the entire West Africa sub-region, which easily has 500 million people, including probably nearly 200 million in Nigeria, you don't have one public hospital in the West Africa sub-region that you could compare with a major public hospital in the United States, such as a Cook County Hospital in Chicago, a Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, or a Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. Okay. If countries would pool together and build such a facility and then allow their citizens to cross borders to receive care in West Africa rather than traveling all the way to the West to receive care, this could go a long way toward improving access to biomedicine in Africa. But again, biomedicine is not the solution by itself. You need a combination of biomedicine as provided in hospitals and other facilities, but also public health. You also need to have behavioral change.
Right.
One of the things that I've noticed in urban Africa is a rise in obesity, probably caused by the proliferation of fast food restaurants. So there will have to be public health campaigns emphasizing behavior modification. Okay, people eating better, people living less of a sedentary life, people walking instead of driving. As Africa's middle class increases, of course, what happens is that, people acquire automobiles, and instead of walking, they drive even over a short distance. This is increasing obesity, and with that, you have an increase in so-called rich man's disease, such as diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. The consumption of processed food may well be responsible for an increase in cancer in parts of Africa. So people have to eat more organic food. And so in the final analysis, healthcare policy has to be holistic. You see, it doesn't have to necessarily to be limited to, to building health facilities. It also has to do with educating people to take better care of themselves rather than having the state or some other entities, intervening on their bodies. And of course, we should also mention, how well you feel physically is not unrelated to how well you feel mentally and spiritually. And so people have to learn to have fun and to enjoy life rather than stressing themselves out. So this should also be part so there ought to be what we may call an economy of leisure that accompanies, healthcare policy, whereby people's mental predisposition is much more positive. Because, how well you feel physically, as I just suggested, depends on how badly or how well you feel mentally. So these are all of the issues that we look at in the book, with varying degrees of emphasis.
Right. Yeah, and that's I think a perfect note on which to end. Positive note of taking in factors including leisure, having fun, lowering stress on a holistic approach to health and healthcare policy. Dr. Kroll, I can't thank you enough for spending time discussing a book I enjoyed very much with me today. And I hope you'll come back when you have a future project.
I will. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Folks, you've been listening to Professor Jean-Germain Kroll discuss his new book, Healthcare Policy in Africa, Institutions and Politics from Colonialism to the Present, published by Robin and Littlefield.